Okay, we are live. Who am I talking to?
And greetings. Yeah, this is D. Greaser up in San Francisco with Indie Bay Radio, Enemy Combatant Radio. And, we were looking at the, by dumb luck, we were looking at the straight news. CNN has got a helicopter apparently flying right above the farm down there in South Central. And so we
You're kidding me.
Better start trying to get some coverage here.
So CNN is taking a few minutes away from the gay marriage debate to see what's going on with the farmers, huh?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think it was Daryl Hannah sitting in a tree. That was the their hook on it.
Yeah.
But at least they're not vociferously opposed to it. I think, you know, they're not necessarily playing it like a tongue-in-cheek thing either. I think it's pretty well recognized that green spaces are a real asset to the community. It's just that developers with a lot of dough have got the ability to buy airtime. So
sure.
Probably torn between two worlds in that. But tell us, let's see, just looking, there are some posts both in the L.A. Indie Media site and then our Indie Bay site has also got a couple of posts that are fairly recent. It sounds like the most recent that I had seen was there were about 10 people that got arrested, and a couple of them were in stretchers.
Yeah, it's my understanding that quite a few people have been getting arrested, and probably more on the way. What is the from your perspective? What is the general attitude? I mean, clearly we like to support workers whenever we get an opportunity, but how do we reconcile this with our beliefs about property rights and ownership and so forth?
Oh, well, I mean, if you just look at it with my angle, I would just say that it's a good idea to have some control of your food source, and locally grown is about as good as you can get, and when you have a community garden, not only is it a good idea to be able to control your food source, but it's also a good idea to train the kids in how to grow their own food and take part in agriculture. There's community gardens are just a wise investment, much less when you look at this aerial photograph, you see nothing but houses for miles on end, and there's this single green patch, and the only green left in L.A., essentially.
Yeah, plus, it's my understanding that the owner of this property wants to put one of what is already many throughout L.A., a warehouse on this property.
Well, God knows we need more warehouses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so, unfortunately, we're sort of left with an ethical argument as opposed to a legal one. I mean, it is his property. He does own it, and it's just wrong that he wants to put a warehouse on it instead of continue to maintain it as a functional farm the way it's been maintained for the past 13 years.
Well, that's that gets into a whole bunch of different angles. It's kind of interesting to look at property rights. There's so many different people throughout the ages that have looked at property. In fact, I think there was an old law of Moses where it said that a new person in the region has to be approved essentially by their neighbors. And their project has to be approved by the neighbors in order to essentially get started. So essentially, even according to Moses, you can't just start polluting and, you know, you don't automatically get a business license to come in. You have to approach your neighbors as if you're going to be a neighbor as well, and then take part in you have to describe to them how you're going to be an asset to the community, and then they will give you permission to do it. And clearly, if you've got a community garden and it's just going to be replaced by some ability to store the vanity of man,
well put.
Seem to be as wise a use of the land as every neighbor and every council would deem. So I'm just looking at it from the kind of basic principles of land use.
Yeah, that's an interesting argument, actually. It's intrinsically antagonistic for him to be putting a warehouse on what is a community farm. You know, I had a neighbor that built an ugly treehouse, and his neighbors made him stop building it and take it down because it was, you know, depreciating the value of the area.
Well, in addition to, with gasoline prices virtually doubling in the last year, the price of food has rapidly increased. And so food that's locally grown is about as smart an idea as you can do. And if there was an economist in that neighborhood that was going to be able to show how much effort it is to haul food in the dozens of miles across the subdivisions of L.A., and from the Central Valley it would still be hundreds of miles. I think I saw a study once that your average strawberry, you get 5 calories out of a strawberry approximately, and it takes about 250 calories to deliver that strawberry to the grocery store shelf. So with all of the heavy equipment, for all of the transfer of water, for all of the pesticides, for all of the pickers and the gasoline that it takes to take that strawberry out of the fields after growing it, and after how much energy it takes to produce all of the pesticides and farm equipment and this and that, it'll take you 250 calories to produce 5 calories. And and so locally grown is smart in any number of different levels. If you're going to have it's probably closer to a 50-fold loss per calorie just to get it delivered to the stores, that's an ugly economic specter. And the idea that you've got one of the rarities of a community garden in South Central, that seems like sabotage to take it out of there.
Do you have any predictions about the outcome of this struggle?
Well, just watching the 2 minutes that I did of CNN, they weren't adverse to keeping the garden. You know, obviously cute movie stars sitting in a tree with impassioned cries to save the save the little garden. It's kind of a being evicted from the Garden of Eden, almost sounds like. And you know, it can be played any number of different ways. If I was a PR agent, I'd have a lark with this one.
Well, is the idea that the farmers will be able to convince the property owner that it's unwise or not in his best interest or just plain wrong to destroy the farm, put a warehouse there? Do you think he could just change his mind under media pressure and stuff like that?
Well, now, this being at the moment where the sheriff's department is doing the raid, and it sounds like there are bulldozers at the ready, it sounds like there's a little more community pressure that needs to be done to get people actually in front of those bulldozers to make sure that those bulldozers can tear up a lot of stuff in 2 minutes' time. So, if I had been involved in this a month or so ago, I would have gone after the guy's financing. Mm-hmm. My understanding, some 15, maybe even 20 years ago, they were trying to build an incinerator in that neighborhood, and the owners of that land, obviously, if you're not able to use that land for 15 years, whether or not they're properly paid up on their real estate taxes, whether their financing is secure, it's always a good thing to study your opposition's financing.
Sure.
And find out if they are if they have enough insurance on it. Find out if they have the full backing to be able to pull off the deal that they're trying to do. Then you get into things like zoning. You can always bottle them up with zoning. If somebody is going to try to build a warehouse cheap, warehouses sometimes can be pretty flimsy. And if we're getting into a world of global warming where high winds and terrible storms are going to start to be a little more normal, the previous zoning laws are not necessarily going to be applicable. So it might be a nice thing to go into the angle of slowing them down with different kinds of environmental impact statements, whether or not this warehouse is just going to be knocked down in the next big storm. And then, of course, you get them in traffic patterns and whether or not a residential area is going to be turned into an industrial area with endless trucks coming in and out, and whether or not you're going to have traffic patterns, and they're going to have to hire all sorts of experts to to help determine what the direction that their trucks are coming from and whether or not they're going to have their insurance raised if they're going to drive through a residential neighborhood and run over one child a year. That can be a pretty hazardous situation. So,
well, what's the opposing argument? I mean, what is the property owner saying? I mean, I'm sure he's heard everything that you just said. Is the opposing argument, yeah, well, it's my land, I can do whatever I want, and this is going to make me the most money? Or is there any legitimacy coming from the other side that this would be a good thing for Los Angeles to change this farm into something else?
Well, I don't really like playing the devil's advocate, and I'm generally, I side generally with the old law of Moses that you've got existing neighbors, and they're being confronted with a new person coming in, pushing an idea.
And you owe them the courtesy.
Yeah, exactly. You have to have, it's not minimally a courtesy, it's a change of life. And if the food and the interactive portions of the society are in that garden, you know, maybe there are little cookouts and picnics. I don't want to say picnics, that's a terrible word now, but the idea that community gatherings can happen in there and that food, clean food that you can trust is grown there, that's something that you can't put a price on by normal means. And there also are historical easement laws, and if this guy had... If there was common land use, and then the commons have essentially been torn away from the public through some financial means, those financial means have to be investigated at best, much less, you know, as if L.A. doesn't have enough warehouses.
Right.
You know, is there really a need for a warehouse, much less in a time when food prices are becoming rapidly higher? I saw some numbers just the other day that the inflation rate is 5% just in the last 6 months.
Hmm.
So at this rate, people are going to have a raise 10% for this year alone. And if the minimum wage doesn't go up 10%, if everybody's wages don't go up 10%, then you're losing. And if people are able to offset their costs of living by growing their own food and not having to drive endless distances to pick up food, then they're at least able to offset the failure to get those raises.
And people forget that over the past several decades, if you account for inflation and the cost of living and so forth, minimum wage has actually gone down roughly 40%.
Yeah,
so
that's
the poorest
right.
of the poor are taking a 40% pay cut.
At the expense of the rich going up hundreds of fold in some cases. What was it, 20 years ago that the average corporate CEO got 17 times what the average employee was, and now they're
yes.
going at something like 400 times? Yeah, it's gotten so insane that the numbers have got to be reevaluated. When you're taking the amount of money that it takes for 17 people to live, and then all of a sudden the same person is taking the amount of money that it takes 400 people to live, that's a lot of starvation and deprivation. So that becomes a hazard to the community when that much money is being controlled in that way. And warehouses are essentially for the storage of vanity, and food is for the preservation of the society. So there's a just an equation that it's common sense to keep food sources viable. And in fact, the idea that so many children don't have a working knowledge anymore of how what it takes to grow food, even in the smallest scale like a backyard garden, ever since the savings and loan scandals of the 1980s, when three-quarters of the small farms, went out of business, that means three-quarters of the generations of farmers now can't train their youth in how to farm in the future. Three-quarters of them.
Wow.
And from the last days of Jimmy Carter to the last days of George Bush the First, we went from 5% of the American population was in agriculture to down to 1.5%. So, yeah, three quarters. I think it went from 12 million people to about 3 million people in agriculture.
Talk about trickle down,
so that's
huh?
A lot of people who now don't have the opportunity to train their next generation in how to farm. So it's all in it's predominantly now in corporate agribusiness, heavy mechanized, robotic agriculture, and the fewer people that are involved in farming, it's putting all your eggs in one basket. So, yeah, the idea of being able to train and teach the young how to raise their own food is absolute necessity to keeping a civilization going, and to be able to actually destroy that is the act of a tyrant. So the idea that this guy who owns the land or claims to own the land is so ignorant as to decimate the ability for a neighborhood to train the youth is he's obviously not a good neighbor.
Yeah, it's interesting how something can be both legal and criminal at the same time. I mean, legally it's his property, so legally he can do this, that, or the other thing with it. However, this act is destructive to the environment, to the population, to civilization. So it's on a humanistic level, it's criminal, even though it's not technically illegal yet. Let me ask you something. One of our producers here at Kill Radio had the sinister idea that what with today being a kind of an important World Cup soccer day, it's interesting that that this day was chosen for the raid, the idea being that the people in support of the farm, Daryl Hannah notwithstanding, are largely Latino, and that population might be, spending time with their families, watching the game, and so forth, and there might be less of them down at the farm than there normally would be. What do you think of that idea? Is that just silly, or is the establishment really that sinister?
Well, the nuances of propaganda. There are so many different people who are very clever at claiming that, say, for example, the new tax breaks for the rich. They're claiming that the rich are too poor to pay taxes and that the poor are too rich to get anything for their taxes. So if you look at it from the viewpoint of taxation with representation, everybody up here in San Francisco, we are an international city. And whether or not people are green card residences or other, we're still dealing with people who pay taxes. Every time they go in the grocery store, they're paying taxes. If they've got children in the schools, they should get some taxation with representation. And we have worked mightily to get non-citizens the ability to vote in San Francisco elections. So, say, for example, for the school board, if you're a resident in the city, you've been living here for 2 years or 20, with or without citizen status, you should have the ability to vote for the people who are educating your children, and for the sewer board, and for the city supervisors, and or the county supervisors, and the various people who do the local representation. We, of course, don't have the ability to grant them the right to vote for the U.S. senators or U.S. Congress people or presidents, but they certainly do have the opportunity of voting in local races. And so taxation with representation is always the issue. This is the social contract. And the idea that whether it's back to that old law of Moses being a social contract, that the neighbors who were there first should have some say about whether or not some interloper is just going to come in and tear up what they had and put in some big ugly mess is certainly the issue. Obviously, it was easier for the incinerator to be stopped, 15 or 20 years ago, because that is an ugly mess and a poisonous one at that. A warehouse is a little more innocuous, but the idea that it makes it so easy. When you look at that aerial shot and you see the broad expanse of L.A. and no green anywhere except for this one box, one rectangle, and the idea that so many people are training children on how to grow food, in L.A., everybody in their right mind must know that that is such a rarity, and it's such a necessity. If we're going to go into a world of global warming and global weather catastrophes, we've got to start training the next generation how to how to deal with food production. This world is not going to be what we think. In fact, even the Pentagon has got studies showing that there are going to be food riots in the year 2020 and because of global warming. And that's not far away. That's not even, it's not even a generation away. And so the idea that, and this is why I brought up the idea that if this guy is going to try to build a warehouse to store things, but in 20 years' time, the weather conditions are going to be so severe that even he's not going to be able to store them properly because it's going to get blown apart by weather conditions.
Let's hope he stores some canned food, huh?
Yeah, it's better to train people in how to do food production and working with the soil, because that's where our future is. Whether we like to think of being city folks or not, if we ignore global warming, we're doing it at our own peril. We've got to train future generations. Millions can be saved with the precious few years that we've got left of this oasis comfort of technology. In 20 years' time, if the Pentagon is expecting food riots in 20 years, that means there's a lot of strife that leads up to it in 10 years, and a lot of devastation that leads up to it in the next 15 years. So it's the awareness and the wise use of our time. So this garden really seems to me to be one of these working models that can be rapidly transformed into growing seed stock for next year. All of the backyards that are not being used for gardens, maybe this patch of 15 acres can be used for growing next year's seed stock, so that you can have some seeds to work from when food prices really go crazy, if they double again next year.
So there's a fair amount of symbolism here with this farm, then. I mean, it's almost like it's the last, one of the few last remaining forts in a long-winded war that seems without end, war against the working poor, against the farmers, and the major casualty being safe, locally grown food. And then the symbolism on the other side that, people who have whatever they feel they need don't really care. Like, for instance, this owner, Ralph Horowitz, has offered to sell the land, 10 acres of it, to the farmers for $16 million, which is, that's like a joke, right? I mean, he wouldn't offer something like that and expect that the farmers, to pool together all their fives and tens and come up with $16 million.
Well, that's the madness of real estate prices since .com, too. It can also be looked at from the economics of pollution. When you've got an acre of land that is polluted, say for example it had a gas station on it or a factory, the average price of land is say in LA region, maybe it's $1 million an acre. Mm. Going to cost you $20 million to clean it up. After it's clean, what do you have left is a $1 million acre. So you've spent $20 million to get $1 million back. So the economics of farmland. This has been a problem forever, where the subdivisions keep crawling into the farmland, and your best soil is covered over by subdivisions. So the idea that real estate prices per house can far exceed the real estate values of arable land, land that can be used for growing food. It's a madness of economics that doesn't make sense, that your best land can be snapped up for factories or subdivisions, and all of a sudden it's not cost effective to grow food anymore. Ergo, it's not cost effective to live.
Right.
That's what they're telling us, is that money is more important than life. And so that's the big lie.
When you initially called, you asked about how many people had been arrested. I'm looking at an article right now from ABC 7, which is the local ABC affiliate here in L.A., and this article is about an hour and a half old. And it says, by 9:30 a.m., nine people on the property grounds had been detained and were booked for violation of the court order and for obstructing a peace officer. And then within the next hour, 25 others were arrested for allegedly blocking the intersection of 41st and Alameda Streets after police declared the gathering an unlawful assembly. This according to the LAPD. How do you think they determine what is lawful assembly and what is unlawful assembly?
Well, I guess it depends on who your PR agent is.
Right.
Whether or not they helped get the sheriff elected. Is the sheriff up for re-election this year?
I actually don't know offhand.
I would think so.
Yeah.
If he wasn't re-elected
haven't heard otherwise.
A couple of days ago, he'd be up for re-election maybe in November. So putting the fear of God into him through re-election opportunities would be one aspect of dealing with it. You know, the numbers are there. You know, property values, you see, this gets into the justification for having those little committee meetings and whatnot beforehand. So many people are opposed to electoral politics. Up here in San Francisco, you know, obviously people think about it as Democrats and Republicans and Greens and whatnot. The Democrats have actually got about 15 or 20 different clubs. So, for example, there's, you know, just in the Castro, there are two different gay Democratic clubs. There's the Arts Democrats, there's the Mission, and the, you know, the Knob Hill Democrats, and there are the Richmond Democrats, and they all have a voice in various, some of them are particular, the Arts Democrats are specific to people in the arts, and theater and music and whatnot. And they have a lobbying power through the Democratic Party. And when a politician wants to get endorsed, they have to go to each one of these groups. And obviously some of them gain power and lose power by individuals, but their totality, they still make a lobbying power. The Greens, to some degrees, haven't developed that same number of clubs. They're slowly but surely increasing, but that sort of thing could easily happen in Los Angeles, whatever political party people want to work with. You create different, you know, the libertarians could have 5 or 10, well, as many people as you got down there, and many libertarians, many Greens, as many Democrats, and Republicans, obviously, you know, work on these angles too, but they try to, unfortunately, they believe in the lobbying power of numbers. They're
yeah.
numerologists by nature, and so it doesn't matter how much ethics a person has, it's whether or not they have the money. And unfortunately for politicians, they tend to look toward that, especially in towns that don't have a lot of political acumen. And so luckily enough, up here, the richer you are, the less likely you are to get reelected or elected.
Huh.
There have been any number of people who have tried to spend millions of dollars to get elected, and they'll just get trounced because money is not everything up here. But in some sections of the world, people fall for the numbers game.
Yeah, well, there's certainly a difference in attitude in Northern California than down here in Southern California about those things. Although statewide, what we're seeing that I think is a positive, slow but growing development is progressive caucuses in the Democratic Party. People organizing within the Democratic Party to say, you know, we have to stop running to the middle. We have to actually start representing the people we claim to represent, and they actually want this, not that. So hopefully there will be something to look forward to in the Democratic Party. Because, you know, if you watch the news, it just, or even if you watch C-SPAN, I mean, it just seems silly. Like, the Democratic Party doesn't even really exist, because whenever one Democrat stands up for something, two other Democrats say, no, that's not really what we stand for.
Well, so that's one of the, a lot of people don't realize it, but Lincoln was a Republican. And if people wanted slavery, they were Democrats. The South were the Democrats. And so Lincoln was the first Republican to get elected. And so for a few decades after his death, the Republicans were seen as the clean party, and the Democrats were seen as the bigots and the, you know, the saboteurs, so to speak. And there was this endless fight between the North and South about the soul of the Democratic Party. There were still plenty of Democrats in the North, and so there was this eternal struggle between the soul of the Democratic Party. And it was only Franklin Roosevelt in the 30s that helped really force the issue, whether or not people were damn fools for siding with the Republicans, who by that time were the party of the rich, and had given up the mantle of being any kind of clean party.
Yeah, well, they essentially switched sides and borrowed each other's issues. I mean, as you pointed out, at one point the Ku Klux Klan was essentially the military wing of the Democratic Party, and then by the time we reached the civil rights era in this country, the tables were turned, and the Republicans, many of whom are still working in government today, you know, voted heavily against civil rights, and the Democrats voted for it, and so on and so forth.
Sure. Well, that said, I'm just wondering, you know, what can be done for the immediate, for this farm. I'm just, I mean, obviously it'd be a good idea to get more people out there.
Yeah, it seems that there's a decent celebrity turnout. You know, it'd be interesting if these guys could come up with the $16 million to buy the property. But just a short list of some of the celebrities who have either shown up or publicly expressed their support. People like Leonardo DiCaprio, Ed Harris, Meryl Hemingway, Rosanna Arquette, Martin Sheen, of course. And, I mean, Daryl Hannah is down there.
Yeah. You know, as a matter of fact, probably $16 million, that would be an easy tax write-off for some of those people, because they make so much per year that a vast amount gets taken out as income tax. So you would think that to develop a nonprofit would be a really smart idea, although these have been striving times, and they probably parked a lot of nonprofit money elsewhere.
But yeah.
But still, this idea of creating a, you know, nonprofit based upon educating the youth in agricultural practices just makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's yeah, we'll see. Actually, you do have a heck of a lineup there. So, with any luck, there are some producers. But I of course, I guess while we're on the line, we should give out the phone numbers. I see that. There are a whole variety of different phone numbers. Of course, there's the mayor's. Let's see. I called up Jan Perry. She's the city. What do you have? A city councilor there? Or what do you have? City council? Is that what LA has?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Jan Perry is your local city councilwoman. 323-846-2651. Leaning on her, and then as well Mayor Vigorosa is 213-978-0600, just calling them. Then apparently this Mr. Horowitz, he has a phone number too. His number is 310-440-7878, 310-440-7878. And let's see, now there was also some discussion of whether or not to call a sheriff. And his phone number is 323-526-5541. And Leroy Baca is the sheriff's name, and seems like he ought to have some scrutiny there, too.
I think one of the things that that these celebrities can help in doing, if they can't just draw up the money, and I think if this issue could be solved with money, they probably already would have been. But they bring in the media. I mean, if CNN is taking a look and the local stations are taking a look, and it's really public opinion. I mean, Ralph Horowitz can try to sell the land for $16 million, but if the public opinion of the entire city of Los Angeles is against him, whatever he builds on that property is going to be a money loser for him if it doesn't have the support of the community.
Yeah, well, that's actually a strong point. And the boycott ability is very high when you imagine that a guy is going to have a $16 million investment that he's going to rapidly lose from.
Yeah.
Yeah, that becomes a law of diminishing return. And no matter how much tax break Bush is going to try to give a guy like that, it still doesn't pay for what he's laid out already. So, you know, he's losing political capital as well as the old green. So, I really don't have a clear idea what that neighborhood is like. From the one angle I saw of it, the aerial photograph, it did really look like a huge amount of residential. And the idea that it would be, you would have endless trucks going in and out to serve a warehouse area of 15 acres. I mean, that's 15 acres makes a huge warehouse.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a reason why the area around the farm would be residential, which is that when you look at the rest of South Central Los Angeles, wouldn't you rather live across the street from a farm than, you know, another office building or another warehouse? So if this farm turns into a warehouse, that's obviously going to change the value of the property all around it in terms of, you know, who wants to live there and how much they're willing to pay for it.
Well, that's right. In addition, though, the idea that he's claiming he wants to build, you know, your average warehouse, you'd be lucky to have one take an acre, no matter how big it is. It's 15 acres is magnificent in terms of putting in 20 warehouses.
Well, yeah, I mean, I suspect that warehouse is really more of a metaphor. You know, what are you going to build on this property? A warehouse. You know, who knows what he's going to build on the property? In a series of warehouses, office buildings, you know, maybe he's going to drill for oil. I mean, it's clear that he doesn't have any respect for the people around him. So I think what's priority number one for him right now is just securing the land, which means removing the people who are, at this point, essentially squatting on it, and then moving from there. And the question is, do we have the time to change public opinion so that the 350 or so farmers who've been working the land for the past several years can hold their ground? Or, you know, do we just wait for the inevitable, which is all of them getting arrested?
Oh, well, the inevitable is global warming, and that's why we really got to get into thinking toward the future, the seven generations, the idea that we've got to train some generations in how to grow food. And warehouses are going to be blown apart by global warming and the massive weather storms. That's why I use this phrase about vanity to store your goods. In history's terms, to allow, what do you say, 350 families, you know, your average 2.5 kids per family, you know, that can be 700 kids that are trained in how to grow food. 700 kids can do a lot in 20 years, 40 years' time. And it's actually very interesting to train people now, because not only would they be trained in the old methods that people have been using for a million years, but with climate change, the idea to compare against the old against the new is a very important thing. If one section of the country previously was desert, and all of a sudden with global warming it becomes much more arable, and one portion that used to be arable is now desert. You have to have people who are experienced in what the norm becomes. And the idea that San Francisco is filled with people of those 350 families that are currently growing there, how many of them were brought up in the Rocky Mountains? How many were brought up in California's Central Valley? How many were brought up in the East Coast? And they're familiar with different plants and different techniques. And the idea that they're able to interact and share information and secrets, this is a unique opportunity. It's very similar, in fact. Up here we had Silicon Valley, and you had all of these very intelligent people who were brought together working on the magnificence of the computer industry, and then because of some financial fraud, all of them were cast to the wind. The diaspora of very intelligent minds were tossed to the wind, and so all of the magnificence of the economy that could have come out of computers is tossed simply because of financial interaction. Well, in this case, you've got 350 families who have learned to work with each other and trade knowledge and help raise each other's children, so to speak, in growing techniques. And then all of a sudden they're going to be tossed to the wind solely because some guy wants to store the vanity of the past.
Well, you know, taking this issue even further, you were saying how it's important that kids in the inner city, or really anyone, learn how to handle and produce their own food. But the way I see it, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There are kids, most of the kids in the inner city, not only don't they know how to produce their own food, they've never even been exposed to real food. They don't even know what food is, what vegetables are, and so on and so forth. I mean, they 7 days a week, they eat primarily fast food and TV dinners. Their food is pre-made, pre-packaged, sanitized with whatever chemicals and hormones. And not to mention how, you know, and this relates, of course, to the obesity problem that's plaguing this entire country. So another thing that's important about farms, in any farms in this country, is that our kids need to be exposed to food, to see what food, you know, what a cucumber looks like. It's really gotten out of control. Every food item comes in a box.
Yeah, the imaginary world, right?
And you know, and in this country, it's one of the rare. Rarest things, it seems that they recently did a study, I read an article about this, the poorer in this country are actually heavier than the rich in this country. And, you know, you'd think just looking at the planet from outer space, it would be a safe assumption that the poorer you are, the skinnier you would be. But it just so happens that the food that is lowest in nutritional value and highest in fat and caloric content happens to be the cheapest, because it's also the most poorly made and produced.
Are you familiar with, there's an old tactic of the Romans, the Caesars, called bread and circuses?
No.
Yeah, it's a famous old thing. This is where white bread came from. If I remember right, the vitamins and minerals in your average wheat berry are 52 minerals and vitamins and minerals.
Mm-hmm.
They take bleach and wash out virtually everything, so you're left with just a paste that has no nutritional value. Then Wonder Bread used to advertise that they'd build strong bodies 12 ways.
Right.
They would take chemical vitamins and just spray them on the top of the bread. And but they would essentially have a useless filler that you could stuff in your stomach, and you would feel food. You would feel full.
Right.
It would essentially have no nutritional value. Well, this was invented by the Caesars, and they knew that in order to keep the people in line, they would have to give them cheap, fattening food to sate their stomachs, and then they would give them entertainment, blood sport, that would sate their bloodlust.
Oh, yes, this does sound familiar. Keep their bellies full and keep them entertained. I think this was also the policy of Saddam Hussein.
Well, every tyrant essentially uses this. So the idea that you would give good nutrition to the people, that will help them think clearly, and you don't have to force opinions on them.
When exactly.
People are thinking clearly, they're going to make generally the right decision. And so the better food you feed people, you don't have to get too political about where to go from there. Usually people's minds work in harmony and in unison when they're eating well. And if they're eating poorly, then they're going to think sluggishly and they're going to essentially fall for whatever hokum is passed for reality. So, yeah, this was, if I understand right, it was Tacticus that came up with bread and circuses. And this was practiced from around the time of Augustus Caesar. And so bleaching the food and giving them enemies, endless enemies and to fear, and then, of course, you'd toss these enemies out on the Colosseum floor and have the lions eat them.
That must obviously be what's happening in this country right now. An endless succession of enemies and... sort of combining, you know, instead of the circus, we have the major media. I mean, the news is equal parts entertainment as it is disinformation. So we have a society growing up on mass, poorly produced, non-nutritional food that has never seen a farm. And they're entertained by, you know, whatever the major media tells them they're supposed to be entertained by. And we're in a constant state of war. And this this issue with the South Central farmers is just a microcosm of what is essentially a world event, which is the destruction of self-sufficiency and nutrition.
Yeah, bread and circuses. That's why I raised the Pentagon studies. This came out about a year ago, that Pentagon had actually done some studies about global warming, and as much as Bush was claiming that it didn't exist, the fact that his own Pentagon was actually, they knew it existed, and that they were planning for it. And so it very much looks like an act of sabotage to not inform the American public that global warming is happening, and so that they are not prepared when the next Katrina hits, when the next blight, the next flood, the next... people would be shocked to learn that as these polar ice caps are melting, diseases that have been frozen for 1,000 years are starting to melt. And the opportunity of getting diseases that we thought were destroyed long ago... all of a sudden, we'd have mass, infections maladies and
epidemics.
Epidemics. That's the word.
Plagues.
Yeah, exactly. And the idea that, in addition, things like these mosquitoes that used to be down in the swamplands of Central America or someplace.
Right, but because of the change in the weather, they have to move.
Well, not just that, but the storms that are blowing 150, 200 miles an hour, sudden if a mosquito can survive it, it's all of a sudden it's in North Dakota, where it used to be down in the swamps of Florida. And so people who are not acclimated to this or that kind of disease are all of a sudden subject to the new diseases, so you would have epidemics based upon new types of plants and animals that are passed around the world, their seeds or the insects.
I'm getting an image in my head of a global warming commission taking place some years after the melting of the polar ice caps, and Condoleezza Rice referring to a memo that says, "Global warming determined to destroy civilization."
Well, that's right, and that's why the idea that money has some sort of an ability to override common sense is this madness that seems to be so pervasive. So I'm just looking at the idea that, you know, you've got an existing working farm of 15 acres, 350 families. My God, where do you get a community of 350 interacting families?
Especially in the heart of a major metropolitan area.
Sure. So is this an act of sabotage on the part of Horowitz? I don't know. Maybe somebody could go down to get some injunctive relief at the federal courthouse. That might be something they could do this afternoon. You know, create a claim to the educational necessity of being able to keep 350 families able to raise food in a time when food prices and food sources are going to become rapidly dwindling. It just seems like an act of sabotage as opposed to self-preservation.
Well, you do have to wonder who Horowitz is really working for. I mean, is he being essentially sent to deliver a message to the working poor? You know, keep your heads down. This is our domain.
Well, it's kind of interesting, too. Whenever I hear that expression, working poor, back 100 years ago, when they first came up with the assembly line, it was recognized that one person could make in 1 hour what it used to take 10 people to make in 20 hours. So with mass production, you can now create so many more products that it makes the lives of all of us easier. And the idea that then everybody would have leisure time, that was kind of half the advantage of it. These assembly lines were going to give leisure time to everybody. Hmm. So now we've got everybody in leisure time, and we're being called poor because we don't have to work. And so they create an onus where those who don't work are some sort of bad, and those that have immense amounts of money and don't work are able to ruin the lives of those that they can slander the best.
I
working poor is one way of phrasing the people that are stuck with minimum wage jobs, but this is a dynamic that theologians and economists were talking about 100 years ago, and it was the fall of Kansas, and it was the fall of the economy in Texas. William Jennings Bryan was talking about this in the 1880s, 1870s even. I will not be nailed to a cross of gold with nails of silver, this famous cross of gold speech. And it's the idea that these fat cats 1,000 miles away can, without knowing what conditions are like in one part of the world, just sign their name on a piece of paper, and all of a sudden the world has to change for them, as opposed to living by the needs of God or nature. And so it's this idea that it's rather unfortunate that Brian got caught up in the evolution scandal, because he took the position that evolution was not a reality, and he kind of ruined his reputation, whereas he did have a strong reputation when it came to economics and ethics. And so he went down in history as the lawyer who opposed evolution in the Scopes monkey trial in the 1920s. But early in his life, he was one strong advocate for getting economic equity. And just one of those unfortunate situations for old William Jennings Bryan. I think he even ran for president once. He's somewhat talked about in The Wizard of Oz as one of those that... trying to think if he was the cowardly lion? No, he was a scarecrow.
Hmm.
The idea that you would have the farmers who don't have a brain, and they were having to fight against the big money, and this man of the earth, but without a brain, and so yeah, there's the old issue of trying to have a world of nature in a world at the same time where money is telling us to believe the shiny trinkets and not believe nature.
Yeah, well, it's a constant struggle. Remind our audiences again who you are and where you're calling from.
Oh, I'm Dee Greaser. I'm up in San Francisco. We've got Indie Media up here has Indie Media for San Francisco, and it's also got Indie Bay, which covers the Bay Area. And we also cover the Northern California, some of the Central Valley. We post stories. Matter of fact, I've been doing plenty of interviews with many of the candidates running the third parties throughout California. Just did an interview this morning with Michael Berg, actually from Delaware.
What's your URL up there so people can check out some of these interviews?
IndieBay.org, and IndieBay.org. And if you also go to Radio Indie Media, that's part of the Indie Media's overall picture for the Micropower radio stations. We post many stories and audio pieces on various issues around the country. And so for the California candidates, I've been putting them on Indie Bay. And then for the candidates throughout the rest of the nation, I've been putting them on Radio Indie Media. So this morning, let's see, I interviewed Michael Wynn. Is it Wynn? He's running for Attorney General here in California. I think it's not Wynn, it's... I'll get it in a second. I've been posting these stories throughout the... I've been posting these stories throughout the year.
Great.
With any luck, we'll have many more of these. Trying to get Peter Cameo on here. I've gotten Todd Craig.
Oh, that would be a great interview. He's very well spoken.
Oh, yeah, and with any luck, we should be able to get him again.
Well, listen, thanks so much for calling in and giving us this very informative discussion. I want to open up the phone lines so some of the people we have down there at the farm right now from Kill Radio can call in and tell us what they're seeing live.
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely need to do that. Hey, have a good afternoon. I see it here. It's Mike Wyman. He's running for Attorney General in California. He's the Green Party candidate, and we'll have that posted on our site. Have a good afternoon, L.A.
Great. Take care. Thanks a lot, San Francisco.
Bastards.
Bye. Again, that website was is indiebay.org, IndieBay.org. Stay tuned to Kill Radio, where we will be playing up. There's another call. Guess I'll keep recording. Kill Radio. Yes. Hey, one second. Let me put you